inched away toward University Drive. Chuckling to myself, I re-entered the store, and Oberon came over and nuzzled against my legs, which was somewhat startling when he was in camouflage.
"Nobody's here now. I want to scratch behind the ears."
I searched and found his head and gave him a good head rub for a minute or so. "Yes, you've been very patient, haven't you?" I said. "Tell you what, next time we go hunting, we'll head down to the Chiricahua Mountains. That's south of here, and I think you'll like it."
"What's down there?"
"Mule deer. Maybe some of those bighorn sheep if we get lucky."
"When can we go?"
"Probably not until this business is over," I admitted. "I know it'll be a long wait for you, but I promise we'll do nothing but hunt once we go. The trip will be for you. But that's not to say you're going to be totally bored in the meantime. We'll probably get attacked at any moment."
"Really?"
"Well, it's more likely going to be after we leave the store." Oberon's ears perked up and he turned to the door.
"Someone's coming."
A customer walked in, looking for a copy of the Upanishads, and after that a fairly steady stream of people were either browsing or buying something. The lunchtime lull was over, and soon enough Perry came back to help out. After giving a regular his customary cup of Daddy's Little Helper, my code for a tea designed to promote prostate health, the phone rang. It was a call from one of Radomiwa's coven.
"Mr. O'Sullivan, my name is Malina Sokolowski. May I speak to you about what occurred between you and Emily this afternoon?"
"Well, sure, but I cannot speak frankly right now. I have customers in the store."
"I understand," she replied.
She had a warm voice and a faint accent that had to be Polish, judging by her name.
"Let me ask you this. Do you consider the contract between you and Emily to still be in effect?"
"Oh, absolutely." I nodded as if she could see it. Nothing happened to nullify that.
"That is reassuring. Would you mind terribly if I accompanied her for tomorrow's tea?"
"I suppose that would depend on your intentions."
"I will not fence with you,"
Malina said. What was this coven's obsession with fencing?
"My intention is to defend Emily in case you attack her again."
"I see. And according to Emily, how many times have I attacked her so far?"
"Once physically and once magically."
"Well, at least you got that part right. But in both cases, Malina, it was she who initiated the attack. I was able to redirect both attacks against her, hence the injuries you have no doubt seen."
"So it's her word against yours?"
She sighed. "Yes, and I understand that you must take her word against mine, but you must understand that she told me her lover is a sworn enemy of mine. By doing so, she has allied your entire coven with him."
"No, that is unthinkable,"
Malina objected.
"If we were allied with this individual, then we would not be trying to humiliate him."
"Why are you trying to humiliate him?"
"That is a question better answered by Radomiwa."
"So put her on. Is she there?"
"Radomiwa is indisposed."
For normal people, that would mean she was taking a shower or something. In Radomiwa's case, it probably meant she was in the middle of a complicated spell involving Tongue of Frog, Eye of Newt, and maybe a packet of Splenda. "I see." A customer with greasy black hair hanging over his face came up to the counter with a bulk bag of incense sticks. "Look, I have to go. You're welcome to come with Emily tomorrow, but it would be best to counsel her to keep silent around me. I can make her tea in silence, and she can drink it in silence. That way no one will get offended or injured. If you'd like to stay behind afterward, perhaps we can talk without coming to blows." Malina agreed, said she looked forward to it, and we rang off. The greasy man asked me if I had access to medical marijuana as an apothecary, and I pasted a sorrowful expression on my face and told him no as I rang up the incense he needed to mask the stink of his habit. Drug addicts perplex me. They're a relatively recent development, historically speaking. Everyone has their theories. Monotheists like to blame it on godlessness. But I think it was a plague that developed in the sooty petticoats of the Industrial Revolution and its concomitant division of labor. Once people specialized their labors and separated themselves from food production and the daily needs of basic survival, there was a hollow place in their lives that they did not know how to fill. Most people found healthy ways to fill it, with hobbies or social clubs or pseudo-sports like shuffleboard and tiddlywinks. Others didn't. Perry finally found some time to mess around with the tarot decks and had a serviceable display up by closing time. I rode quickly to the widow's house after locking up the store and retrieved the push mower from her shed in the backyard.
"Ah, you're a fine boy, Atticus, and that's no lie,"
she said, saluting me with her whiskey glass as she came out to the front porch to watch me work. She liked to sit in her rocking chair and sing old Irish songs to me, old for her anyway, over the whirl of the lawnmower blades. Sometimes she would forget the words and simply hum the tune, and I enjoyed that just as much. When I was finished, I always spent a pleasant time with her, hearing stories of her younger days in the old country. That day, as the sun was setting and the shadows were lengthening, she was telling me something about running around the streets of Dublin with a bunch of ne'er-do-wells.
"This was all before I met me husband, of course,"
she made sure to add. I had Oberon stationed as sentinel on the edge of the lawn close to the street. As the widow regaled me with tales of her golden age debauchery, I was depending on him to tell me of approaching danger.
"Atticus,"
he said as the widow was winding up her tale with a sigh over better days and a better land.
"Someone comes on foot from the north."
"Is he a stranger?" I had put Fragara aside while I talked to the widow, but now I stood and slung the scabbard back over my head, causing the widow to frown.
"Yes, he is very strange. I can smell the ocean on him from here."
Uh-oh. That's not good. Stay still and try not to make any noise. "Excuse me, Mrs. McDonough," I said. "Someone's coming and he might not be friendly."
"What? Who is it, Atticus?"
I couldn't answer yet, so I didn't. I kicked off my sandals and drew power from the widow's lawn even as I walked toward the street and peered northward. One of the charms on my necklace has the shape of a bear on it, and its function is to store a bit of magical power for me that I can tap when I'm walking on concrete or asphalt. I topped off the magical tank as a possible antagonist approached. A tall, armored figure clanked noisily on the asphalt a couple of houses away, and it raised a hand to hail me when I came into view. I activated a different charm that I call Fairy Specs, a sort of filter for my eyes that lets me see through fey glamours and detect all sorts of magic juju. It showed me the normal spectrum, but then there was also a green overlay that revealed what was going on magically, and right now the two layers showed me the same thing. So whoever he was, I was looking at his true form. If he had something similar to my fairy specs, he might be able to see through Oberon's camouflage, but then again he might not. He was wearing rather gaudy bronze armor that no one would have worn in the old days. The cuirass, faced in hardened leather dyed with woad, covered too much and restricted movement. He had leaf-shaped tassets hanging down over a bronze mail skirt. He also had 5-piece pauldrons and matching vambraces and greaves. It would have been hot enough to wear such armor in Ireland, but here the temperature was still in the low 90s, and he must have been broiling in it. His helmet was beyond ridiculous. It was one of those medieval barbutes that didn't become popular until 1,000 years after his halcyon days of slaughter, and he must have been wearing it as a joke, though I did not find it especially funny. A sword hung in a scabbard at his side, but thankfully he did not carry a shield.
"I greet you, Siohan O'Sullivan," he said. "Well met."
He flashed a smug grin at me through his helmet, and I wanted to slay him on the spot. I kept my fairy specs on because I simply didn't trust him. Without some way to pierce his glamour, he could make my eyes think he was standing 3 feet away with his hands on his head while he was really plunging a dagger into my belly. "Call me Atticus. I greet you, Bress."
"Not well met?"
He tilted his head a bit to the right, as much as the barbute would let him. "Let's see how the meeting goes. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, and I wouldn't have minded if it were longer. And by the way, the Renaissance Festival doesn't arrive here until next February."
"That's not very hospitable," Bress said, frowning.
Oberon was right. He smelled of salt and fish. As a god of agriculture, he should smell of earth and flowers, but instead he retained the stink of the dockside, owing perhaps to his Fomorian ancestors who lived by the sea.
"I could take offense if I wished."
"So take it already and be done. I can't imagine why else you would be here now."
"I am here at the request of an old friend," he said.
"Did he request that you dress like that? Because if he did, he's not your friend."
"Atticus, who is that?"
the widow McDonough called from her porch. I didn't take my eyes off Bress as I called back to her. Someone I know. He won't be staying long. Time to set up my flanking maneuver. Speaking mind to mind, I said to Oberon, remain still, but when I say get behind him, grab a leg and just yank him off his feet. Once he's down, jump clear.
Got it,
Oberon said. Bress continued as if the widow had never spoken.
Angus Og wants the sword. Give it to me and you'll be left alone. It's that simple.
Why isn't he here himself?
He's nearby, Bress said.
That was calculated to ratchet my paranoia up a few levels. It worked, but I was determined it would not work in his favor. What's your stake in this, Bress?
And what's with the armor? That does not concern you, Druid. Your only concern is whether you will agree to give us the sword and live, or refuse and die.
The last fingers of the sun were waving goodbye over the horizon, and twilight was upon us. Fairy time. Tell me why he wants it, I said. It's not like Ireland has a high king who needs the Tuatha De Danann to help him out uniting all the various tribes.
It is not for you to question.
Sure it is, I said. But I guess it's not for you to answer. Fragoraz right here. I gestured to the hilt peeking over my shoulder. So if I give it to you now, you walk away, and I never hear from you or Angus again? Bress peered intently at the hilt for a few moments, then chuckled.
That is not Fragoraz. I have seen it, Druid, and I have felt its magic. You have nothing in that scabbard but an ordinary sword.
Wow. Radomiwa's magical cloak just rocked. And then the green overlay in my vision started to differ from the normal spectrum. Bress was pulling his sword out of his scabbard in a leisurely fashion and watching my face to see if I reacted, so I tried to stay relaxed and let him think I was clueless. Either he knew that I really had Fragoraz on my back and he wanted to double-cross me, or he simply wanted to kill me to burnish his reputation. He'd make a fine tale of the battle, no doubt, in spite of the fact that he was planning the equivalent of a stab in the back. I assure you it's the real thing, I said to him. And to Oberon I said, change in plan. Just lie down behind him when I say, I'll push him over your back so he falls down.
Okay.
Bress's glamour form shrugged and said,
you can give your cheap sword to me if you'd like. It'll only delay things, and I'll have to come back again with another offer. But I can guarantee that offer won't be as generous as the one I'm giving you now.
And that was when the true Bress on the green overlay grinned wickedly and raised his sword over his head in a two-handed grasp, ready to split me in two.
Now, Oberon,
I said, keeping my face pensive as if I were thinking over Bress's words. I started talking out loud to hopefully mask any sounds Oberon made as he moved. Bress, I think you're missing something important, I said, even as he brought his sword down with all his strength and I stepped out of the way to the right at the last instant. His glamour persona was still standing there smirking, but I didn't pay attention to that one anymore. The green one, the real Bress, had just tried to slay me. While he was hunched over awkwardly on his follow-through, I kicked at the nerve cluster in his wrist to make him drop the sword, then put another one in his face to make him stand back up. It didn't get through his helmet, but any blow to the head is going to make you pull away. Then I pivoted on my left foot and spun clockwise, delivering a roundhouse into his solar plexus before he could set himself. He staggered backward and fell over Oberon in a tremendous clatter of bronze and hardened leather, still not hurt, but pretty humiliated by this point. He gave up on the glamour, and the smirking Bress merged with the one on the ground, so that my fairy specs and my normal vision showed the same thing again. I could have left it there. He was disarmed and no danger to me now, and if any of the Fae had been around to see him fall flat on his ass, he would be shamed in a legendary fashion. Except that he had tried to kill me with a glamour. He would never fight me fairly, because he could not win that way. He'd never been much of a terror on the battlefield. If I let him live, then he would send a series of assassins my way, just as Angus Og had been doing for centuries. I didn't need twice the headache I already had. Plus, in the parlance of our times, he was a douchebag. So I didn't leave it there. While he was still on the ground, I whipped Fragoraz out of its scabbard and plunged it straight through the center of his bronze cuirass, which offered no resistance to the magical blade. Bress's eyes bulged, and he stared at me in disbelief. After surviving the epic battles of ancient Ireland, in respectable armor, during which he could have died heroically, he was going to meet his end in a fight that lasted less than 10 seconds because of his own overconfidence. I didn't gloat over him, because that's how people get cursed. I yanked Fragora out of him quickly, causing him to gasp in pain, and then I brought the sword down on his neck, severing his head before he could utter a death curse against me.
"When he said to give him the sword, I don't think he meant for you to stick it in his guts,"
Oberon said. He took a swipe at me with his sword. I replied.
"He did? Well, I didn't see that."
"He didn't see you either. Well done."
"You killed him,"
I heard a tiny voice say. I turned to see the widow standing up, whiskey glass trembling in her hand before it slipped out and shattered on her porch.
"You killed him."
Her voice quavered.
"Are you gonna kill me too now? Send me home to the Lord so I can be with Michonne."
"No, Mrs. McDonough, no, of course not." I resheathed Fragora to remove the thread it represented, even though the blade wasn't clean. "I have no reason to kill you."
"I am a witness to your crime."
"It wasn't a crime. I had to kill him. It was self-defense."
"It didn't look like self-defense to me,"
she said.
"You kicked him and pushed him and then you stabbed him and cut off his head."
"I don't think you saw the whole thing," I replied, shaking my head, "because I was partially blocking your view. He tried to stab me with his sword. See it lying there on the ground? I didn't pull that out of its scabbard. He did." I stayed where I was and let her process it. When someone thinks you might kill them, the last thing you want to do is edge closer to them in an attempt to comfort them, but people always seem to do it in the movies. The widow squinted at the dim outline of the sword, and I watched the doubt seep into her expression.
"I thought I heard him threaten you,"
she said.
"But I didn't see him move until you kicked him. Who was he? What did he want?"
"He's an old enemy of mine," I began, and the widow interrupted.
"Old enemy? Aren't you only 21? How old could your enemies be?"
Gods below, she really had no idea. "He was old in the way I see things," I said. And then I thought of a story to tell her. "He was really an old enemy of my father's, so he's been my enemy from the day I was born, if you see what I mean. And after my father passed away years ago, I became the target instead. That's why I moved here, you know, to get away from him. But I heard a couple days ago that he had found me and was coming, so I started wearing this sword to protect myself."
"Why didn't you get yourself a gun like all these American boys do?"
I grinned at her. "Because I'm Irish, Mrs. McDonough. And I'm your friend." I modulated my expression to earnest pleading and clasped my hands together. "Please, you have to believe me. I had to kill him or be killed myself. And I hope you know that I would never, ever hurt you." She was still unconvinced, but was wavering.
"What was the nature of the argument he had with your da?"
she asked. I couldn't fabricate a plausible lie on the spot, so I told her a part of the truth. "It was about this sword, actually," I said, jerking my thumb back to the hilt. "Da stole it from him long ago, but in a way it's more like he brought it home. It's an Irish sword, you know, but this bloke had it in his private collection, and it didn't seem right, him being British and all."
"He's British?"
"Aye." I felt ashamed for pushing the widow's buttons like this, but I couldn't afford to keep talking all night with a decapitated body in the street. Her husband had been in the provost during the Troubles and was killed by the UVF, whom the widow had always assumed, rightly or not, to be puppets of the British.
"Ah, well then you can bury the bastard in me backyard, and goddamn the Queen and all her hellish minions."
"Amen," I said, "and thank you."
"Not at all, me boy,"
the widow said, and then she laughed.
"You know what Michonne used to say, God rest his soul? He said, 'A friend will help you move, Katie, but a really good friend will help you move a body.'"
She cackled hoarsely and clapped her hands together.
"Not that I can help you move a big bugger like that. Do you know where the shuffle is?"
"Aye, that I do. I wonder, Mrs. McDonough, if you would have some lemonade or something in the house? I have a feeling I'll need it."
"Oh, sure, me boy. I can whip something up. You just get busy and I'll come out with a glass."
"Thank you so much." As she disappeared inside, I turned back to Oberon, who was still in camouflage. "Think you can carry the head back to the backyard? We need to get this out of sight." Night had fallen, but the street lamps were coming on, and anyone driving down the street would see a slight problem in their headlights.
"Not much to grab onto with that helmet on. I guess I could nudge it along with my nose."
"Good enough," I said. As I bent down to pick up the body, and Oberon began playing a macabre game of snout soccer, the battle crow showed up. It took one look at the carnage and squawked angrily at me.
"I know," I said in an urgent whisper. "I'm in deep trouble. If you will follow me to the backyard, we should be able to speak privately there."
The crow squawked once more before launching itself into the air and flapping over the roof. I hauled Bress off the street and slung him over my shoulder in a fireman's carry. I felt his blood oozing through the back of my shirt. I'd have to burn it. When I got to the backyard, the Morrigan was already in human form, standing pale and silent with her hands on her hips. Her eyes were glowing. This wasn't going to be a nice chat.
"When I agreed to your immortality, that did not give you permission to kill the Tuatha De Danann," she spat.
"Surely I don't need permission to defend myself," I asked. "He tried to use his glamour to cut me down, Morrigan. If I hadn't been wearing my necklace, I never would have seen the sword he pulled on me."
"You would have survived,"
the Morrigan pointed out. "Aye, but in what condition? Forgive me if I did not wish to experiment with various levels of pain and disembowelment," I said as I lowered my shoulder and let Bress fall unceremoniously onto the widow's Bermuda grass.
"Tell me precisely what happened, every word that passed between you."
I told her, and she regarded me with stony silence, except for those red eyes. They finally dimmed when I told of how I had used a camouflage dog to trip him and finish him off.
"Well, that was unforgivably arrogant of him. He deserved to die a fool's death," she said. "And look at that horrendous armor."
But then she looked at his head resting a yard to the right, and her eyes blazed red again.
"When Briett hears of this, she will want me to bring her your head, and I will have to tell her no. Do you know what position that puts me in, Druid?"
"I am sorry, Morrigan. But perhaps if you tell Briett precisely how he died, she'll be less inclined to demand blood for blood. Think of your own reaction to it. His death was the most dishonorable of any of the Tuatha De Danann. And why was he doing Angus's bidding anyway? Demanding restitution for one such as he would be almost ridiculous." Her eyes cooled down as she considered my words.
"You reason well. Perhaps we can avoid conflict if we present it to her properly."
She looked again at Bress's headless body and his head sitting at Oberon's feet.
"Leave the body with me," she said. "I will take care of it."
I was only too glad to let her. "My thanks. If you have no objection, I'll go wash the blood out of the street."
"No, go ahead."
The Morrigan flicked her hand dismissively, her eyes still on the body, and I took off before she changed her mind. Besides, I honestly didn't want to see what she was going to do. I grabbed the garden hose attached to the front of the house and turned it on full blast. The widow came out with a glass of lemonade for me and a fresh whiskey for herself, surprised to see me back so soon.
"Have you buried the feckin' teabag already?" she said.
"No," I admitted, and tried to cover my shock at the widow's language. "I just came back to wash the blood out of the street."
"Ah, well then, I'll leave you to it,"
she said, handing me the glass and patting me gently on the arm.
"I think it's time for Wheel of Fortune, you know."
"Good night, Mrs. McDonough." She swayed a bit as she searched for the door handle.
"You're a good lad, Atticus, mowing me lawn and killing what Brits come around."
"Think nothing of it, please," I said. "And it's probably best if we kept this between us."
"Of course,"
she said, finally finding the door and yanking it open.
"Good night."
As the door closed behind her, Oberon said,
"You know, I think the television might have desensitized her to violence."
"That or living in Northern Ireland during the Troubles," I said.
"What were the Troubles about?"
"Freedom, religion, power, the usual. Would you mind standing sentinel again on the edge of the lawn while I do this?"
"No problem."
I took out Fragora first to hose it down, then pointed the spray at the street to wash the worst of the gore away. I was just about finished when I heard Oberon's voice in my head, sounding very tense.
"Hey, you said to listen for heavy footsteps. Well, I hear a whole bunch of them, and I think they're coming this way."
Chapter 10. "Time to go home," I said, throwing down the hose and scrambling back to turn off the water. I hopped onto my bike and told Oberon we were going full tilt. I had to get away from the widow's house or she could become a casualty.
"What's making that noise?"
he asked, his long stride keeping pace with my bike as I pumped furiously to get some speed.
"Those are the Firbolgs,"
I told him in my mind, saving my breath for bike riding.
"I think they sped up. They're running now."
"They've spotted us. Don't look back. Keep going. Now listen, these guys carry spears, but you won't see them. Just trust me, they'll have them. They're not going to see you either. What I want you to do is go for their left legs, that soft spot above the ankles."
"The Achilles tendon? I remember that."
"Good, but you need to go for their calves. These guys are actually a lot bigger than they look, and their Achilles tendons are going to be about where a human's calf would be. I want you to bite them once and then get the hell out of the way before they fall on you or take a swipe at you."
"But what if they're wearing armor?"
"They won't be. Anything you see is an illusion. They're going to be barefoot, most likely. They have pretty tough hides." I risked a look back up Roosevelt as I turned the corner onto 11th. My normal vision showed me 9 assholes in Harley-Davidson riding gear running after me under the streetlights as if I'd just toppled their bikes outside the pool hall. My fairy specs showed me 9 nearly naked Firbolgs wearing nothing but breechcloths and woad. They carried spears in their right hands and large wooden shields in their left, and they were grinning in anticipation because they were gaining on me. When I got to my house, I rode up on the lawn and leapt off my bike, letting it roll riderless up to the porch. I heard a curse coming from the porch, and I drew Fragorov from its scabbard, wondering who was lying in wait for me there.
"Damn you, Atticus, what are you playing at?"
a familiar voice said as my bike came to an abrupt halt and then got tossed half the distance back to me. I felt my face relax into a brief grin.
"Leaf,"
I called, and he could not help but hear the relief in my voice.
"I'm glad you're here."
I'd forgotten I'd asked Hal to send him as soon as the sun set. "I hope you're dressed for a fight."
"A fight? Is that what I hear coming down the road?"
My vampire attorney stepped from the shadow of the porch into the dim glow of the streetlights. A white mane of hair floated around his pale face, which was scowling at me above an impeccably tailored suit, not dressed in his fighting togs then. The Firbolgs rounded the corner, and the noise of their approach became intimidating, even without the senses of a vampire. "I didn't intend this, Leaf," I said, "but if you don't help me now, you might not have your favorite client around anymore. There's 2 glasses in it for you."
"In addition to my fees?"
He raised his eyebrows. "No, 1 glass is your fee, the other is off the books for your help in this fight." There was no time to negotiate. He nodded once and said,
"They do not look very tough."
"They're giants using glamour, so don't trust your eyes. Use your other senses. What does their blood smell like?" They were almost upon us, but it was a worthwhile question. Leaf's eyes widened as he caught the scent of their blood.
"They are strong," he said. "Thanks, Atticus."
He grinned, his fangs lengthening as he smiled.
"I have not had my breakfast yet."
"Look at it like an all-you-can-eat buffet," I said. And then there was no more time for talking. Not one to be shy, Leaf launched himself in a superhuman leap against the leading Firbolg, far above where his head was, according to mortal eyes. That's because the giant's neck was actually about 3 feet higher, and the Firbolgs slowed down when they saw their leader taken down by a guy in an English business suit. But slowing down wasn't the same thing as stopping.
"Go, Oberon. Good hunting."
He loped away and I drew power from my front lawn, exulting in the feeling as it coursed through my cells after channeling through my ancient tattoos. The intricate knotwork traveled from the sole of my right foot up the outside of my ankle and right side, until it snaked over my right pectoral muscles and around to the top of my shoulder, where it fell like an indigo waterfall to the middle of my biceps. There it looped around 5 times until it threaded down my forearm, ending, if Celtic knots can be said to end at all, in a loop on the back of my hand. The tattoos were bound to me in the most intimate way possible, and through them I had access to all the power of the earth, all the power I would ever need, so long as my bare foot touched the ground. In practice, that meant I would never, ever tire in battle. I suffered no fatigue at all, and if I needed it, I could whip up a binding or two against my enemies, or summon up a temporary burst of strength that would allow me to wrestle a bear. It had been a long, long time since I had felt the need to summon so much power. But then again, I hadn't been in a scrap like this since I'd waded into the mosh pit at a Pantera concert. 9 firbolgs, well, 8 now, were a few more than I had been expecting. I moved to put my mesquite tree behind my back as an obstacle in case any of them were thinking about surrounding me. Then I pointed my finger at the first firbolg to set foot on my lawn and said, "Kani!" Literally, hold or detain. And the earth moved to do my will. It gave way and then reformed around the firbolg's feet, rooting him abruptly and very firmly to the spot. To say he was surprised would be putting it mildly. With so much forward momentum, his bones had no choice but to break above the ankle when his feet were suddenly and inflexibly held in place. The bones ripped out through the back of his calf, and he flopped face down in front of me, sans feet and screaming. That was not the way I had envisioned things working out. I had hoped he would brace himself, keep his feet, and serve as a wall between me and the fellows behind him. No such luck. His buddies kept coming, enraged rather than cautioned by their comrade's fall, and I now had to deal with 3 spears thrusting at my vitals. Real fights don't look as pretty as the ones you see in movies. Those are choreographed, especially the martial arts ones, to seem so beautiful that they are practically dances. In true combat, you don't pause, pose, and preen. You just try to kill the other guy before he kills you. And winning ugly is still winning. That's what Bress failed to understand, and that's why I got rid of him so easily. Firbolgs have none of that pretentiousness. And even if they did, they would have lost it quickly after seeing Leaf take down their leader in the street, and then another one lose his feet in my lawn. No, these lads were betting that I wouldn't be able to dodge 3 spears thrust at me from a height from 3 different angles. I might be able to deflect one and dodge another, but the third one would get me. If I jumped straight up or back, I'd get tangled up with my own mesquite tree. If I rolled forward beneath their thrusts, they'd just stomp on my dumb ass. I was guessing these guys were pushing 600 pounds, so I didn't want to be in the middle of their clog dance. That meant I had less than a second to do some impossible shit. The ones on the left and the center had solid footing for their thrusts, but the one on the right had to plant his foot squarely on the back of his fallen, screaming, footless friend. So that was the one I was willing to take my chances with. I leapt to the left, leaving the ground, which they obviously did not expect. Since the lad on the right was out of reach, I slashed at the spearheads of the other two and was gratified to see Fragora cleave through them easily. But it was too easy. The cut was so clean that while the heads careened off at an angle, the shafts continued on course, and so both of them caught me full force, one in the shoulder, one in the gut. They threw me backward to crack my back painfully against the trunk of my mesquite tree, and I had been planning such a graceful tuck and roll, too. The firbolg on the right had missed completely, his thrust stabbing the air where I had been, but he was stepping off his screaming friend's back and preparing for another thrust. "Kani," I said, pointing at him, and he unexpectedly found himself immobile. While he tried to figure out what to do about his captured feet, I returned my attention to the first two giants, who were now holding long wooden staves. I assume that the other 4 firbolgs were anxious to get at me too, but perhaps Leaf and Oberon were keeping them busy. I saw nothing beyond my own personal battle. The one who had been the center attacker decided to steal the spear of his footless friend, since he wasn't doing anything except bleeding to death. As he bent down to retrieve it, the one on the left decided he would try playing golf with my head. Well, that was easy enough to deal with. I held out Fragora in the path of his swing, and then I was able to spend a couple of seconds concentrating on the pain my tumble had caused. The blow to my shoulder had deeply bruised the muscle, and it wouldn't be much use until I healed it. The shot to my abdomen was much more serious. It had penetrated, though not through, to the intestines, and I was bleeding freely. As for my back, I was damn lucky I had not broken it. It was probably a chiropractor's wet dream, as it was. I wished I could do one of those ridiculous fairy godmother routines, where you just wave a wand, some sparkly lights fill your vision, and then everything is all better. But my magic doesn't work like that. I can start the healing process and accelerate it, and I can force my body to ignore pain, but I cannot simply make damage disappear. So I did what I could in 2 seconds. I activated the healing charm on my necklace, which blocked pain and put me firmly on the mend, and then I had to move. Golf Boy was getting ready to take another swing, his first one shortened a foot or so by Fragora. The lad from the center now had his footless mate's spear and was ready to skewer me with it. The immobilized one had decided to throw his spear at me, off balance though he might be. It was time to take the offensive. I gathered myself into a crouch and then leapt, but this one was more like Leaf's. I put some earth power behind it, so I was fairly launching myself at the Firbolg's would-be Phil Mickelson. He saw my intent and raised his shield, but that was what I was counting on. I slashed down from right to left and followed through as I arrived, cutting cleanly through both his shield and his skull before crashing my right shoulder into the remainder of his shield and sliding back down to the earth with his crumpling body. The Firbolgs get my highest marks for battle savagery. The slain giant's fellows spared him not a single thought, but only looked for vulnerabilities my attack might have exposed. I had to whip Fragora back up across my body to deflect a thrown spear from the immobilized one, then back down to neutralize the thrust of the other.
Kani!
I said once more, and now the ladder was frozen in place too. I could safely move away to confront other threats and come back to finish them off later. Another of the Firbolgs had tried to flank me, but in doing so he had strayed too close to my house and activated the wards. He was busy fighting off some tangling bougainvillea vines that were trying to bring him to ground, and he wasn't enjoying the thorns. I spun around to the street, trying to get some perspective on the remaining foes, and saw that two more were down in the street. One was dismembered, and another had Leaf attached to his neck, and drinking deeply. There was one more, and this one was spinning around clumsily, counterclockwise, and stabbing at the ground at something unseen. It was Oberon, harrying the Firbolg's legs. I could not bear it if my friend was lost, so I sprang to help. I lopped off the giant's spear arm at the elbow the next time he spun around, and then I thrust Fragora underneath his ribs to end it.
"Yikes," Oberon said as the giant fell heavily into the street. "They have tougher skin than I thought. All I was able to do was tick them off."
"That was enough, my friend. Stay here while I take care of the stragglers." I cast camouflage on myself and my sword, and then I crept up behind the two immobilized Firbolgs and stabbed Fragora up into their kidneys. Cowardly? Blech. Tell you what, let's debate the meaning of honor and see who lives longer. The last Firbolg died in a mess of vines and blood, and only then did I relax the bindings of my lawn, allowing the earth to spit the giant's feet back up. I dropped my camouflage and swept the area with my eyes and my other senses, looking for additional threats, but all I saw were 9 massive corpses and a whole lot of blood. The Firbolg's glamours had died with them, leaving me with a colossal cleanup problem. I didn't want to ask the earth to swallow these guys. I had asked so much of it already, and besides that, I doubted there would be time. I wasn't as fast as Flittish when it came to moving large amounts of earth, and I imagined someone had called the police by now. As if on cue, I heard sirens in the night air, and that drew my gaze to the parted living room blinds of my neighbor across the street, whose large round eyes were staring fearfully at me as if I somehow was the bad guy. Great. "Leaf?" I said. "Hey, Leaf, aren't you full yet?"
"Ah,"
my lawyer said, tearing himself away from his breakfast and belching softly.
"Very full. Thank you."
"Well, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, perhaps you could help me here. The police are on their way, and we have a lot of evidence to hide."
"Oh,"
the vampire said, seeming to remember suddenly that his job was to keep me out of jail. He looked down at his tailored English business suit, now stained with copious amounts of blood, and then back up at my shirt, which was rather bloody as well.
"Yes, it would appear that there is a lot of evidence to hide."
"Go inside and change real fast. There's a suit in my closet and you can grab me a fresh shirt," I said, pulling mine off and handing it to him. "Then come back and do your freaky memory thing with my neighbor across the street. He's the source of our police problem." Leaf moved with all the speed at his disposal. He knew he had a couple of minutes at most, probably less, before the police would arrive. In that time, we had to make it look as if no one had died here tonight. I went back to my lawn and summoned some more power. It allowed me to drag 600-pound giant bodies quickly to the east side of my lawn, farthest from my driveway, and stack them on top of one another. The ones in the street would have to be Leaf's problem. The power stored in my bear charm would drain quickly if I tried to handle them alone. But what I could do was cast camouflage on all the bodies and the spreading pools of blood. Oh, and maybe I should conceal my sword, too. Nothing to see here, coppers. Move along. Leaf returned in a minute, wearing a suit I had bought at the men's warehouse.
So, did you like the way you looked wearing this?
He said, mocking the commercials as he tossed me a fresh T-shirt. It didn't fit him perfectly. It was tight across the chest, and he was a little longer of limb than I. He was a bloody Viking, after all. The sirens were awfully close.
You need to get those bodies out of the street and put them over there, I said, pointing to the pile I had made, and then take care of my neighbor's delusions.
No problem, he said,
and then he zipped out into the street and started tossing giants, being careful not to get blood on his hands. I pulled on the clean shirt and kept my eyes on the blinds across the street. My neighbor, Mr. Simurgian, had always been the snoopy sort. He had held me in deep suspicion from the day I moved in, because I did not own a car. I started casting camouflage on every spot of blood I could find, and then on the pile of bodies as well. Leaf ran across the street to lay some vampire hoodoo on Mr. Simurgian.
Look into my eyes, you didn't see anything.
It was like an old Jedi mind trick. I was fairly confident I had taken care of all visible evidence before the first patrol car rounded the corner. If they went snooping around the east side of my lawn, they would run into some major invisible evidence, but hopefully they would never have reason to do that. As they wailed down the street, I muttered a little something to magnify the scent of local plant life, which would hopefully mask the scent of so much spilled blood. I sent Oberon to sit quietly on our front porch while Leaf and I dealt with the authorities. He probably needed another bath anyway. Three black and whites pulled up to my house, alerting all my other neighbors that the noise they had been ignoring was something to worry about after all. Six officers jumped out of the cars and pointed guns at us over their car doors.
"Freeze!"
one of them shouted, even though we were standing perfectly still. Another one snarled,
"Hands above your head!"
And yet another said,
"Drop the sword!"
Chapter 11. How can one freeze and put their hands above their head at the same time? Do they teach cops to shout contradictory instructions at suspects at the academy for some sinister purpose? If I obeyed one cop, did the other cop get to shoot me for resisting arrest? The only one who worried me was the guy who told me to drop my sword. It was camouflaged, but still hanging in its scabbard across my back. Could he see through the camouflage?
"Good evening, gentlemen," Leaf said smoothly.
Neither of us raised our hands.
"I am an attorney for Mr. O'Sullivan here."
All the cops looked at him standing there serenely in his suit and got real quiet. "I am an attorney" is a trigger phrase for cops. It tells them they have to go slow and follow procedures or their case will get tossed out of court. It meant that they wouldn't be able to wave their guns around and bully me into anything. Unfortunately, it also told them that I needed an attorney at my house after normal business hours. If I were a mind reader, I would be hearing the same thing from each one of their heads. This bastard is so guilty he already has his lawyer here.
"What can we do for you tonight?" Leaf asked pleasantly.
"We received a call that there was someone cutting down people with a sword here," one of them said.
Leaf snorted in amusement.
"A sword? Well, I suppose that's refreshing, perhaps even charmingly retro. But would there not be some signs of struggle if that were the case? People missing their arms, lots of blood, and maybe an actual sword in somebody's hand? You can see for yourselves that nothing like that is going on here. All is well. I think you received a crank call, officers."
"Then why are you here?"
the cop asked.
"I'm sorry, officer,
It's Benton.
"Officer Benton, I am Leif Helgerson. I am here because Mr. O'Sullivan is not only my client, he's my friend. We were simply standing here enjoying the autumn evening and discussing baseball when you drove up and pointed your weapons at us. Speaking of which, isn't it about time you put those away? Neither of us is about to threaten you."
"Let me see your hands first,"
Officer Benton said.
Leif slowly took his hands out of his pockets, and I did the same, raising them to shoulder height.
Look,
Leif said, wiggling his fingers like they were jazz hands.
No swords.
Officer Benton scowled at him, but then he reluctantly put away his sidearm, and the other officers followed his example.
I think we should take a look around, just to be thorough, he said, stepping around his car door and walking toward us.
You do not have probable cause to look around, Leif told him as he lowered his hands and crossed his arms. I put mine in my pockets.
The 911 call gave us probable cause, Benton countered.
A crank call that clearly has no basis in fact. The only disruption to the peace in this neighborhood tonight has been your sirens, and if you want to search my client's property, you should go get a warrant.
What is your client trying to hide? Benton asked.
It is not a matter of hiding anything, Officer Benton, Leif said. It is a matter of protecting my client against unreasonable search and seizure. You have absolutely no reason to search these premises. Your call described a sword fight in progress, but nothing like that has gone on here, so I think your time would be better spent protecting the city from real threats instead of imaginary ones. In addition, if the caller was the elderly Lebanese gentleman across the street, he has a long history of harassing my client over imagined trespasses. We are considering a restraining order against him. Officer Benton looked supremely frustrated. He knew, he just knew I was hiding something. And of course he was right. But he wasn't used to dealing with lawyers. Detectives usually handled them. And he wasn't confident enough to proceed when he couldn't see anything wrong. Apparently the officer who had told me to drop the sword couldn't see it strapped to my back either, because he hadn't said a word since he got out of the car. He must have been shouting at me based on the 911 call. All hearsay. But Benton couldn't resist trying to bully me anyway.
"Haven't you got anything to say, mister?" he sneered at me. Why did we get called out here?
Well, I said, I cannot say for certain, of course, but it might be because Mr. Simurgian across the street there really doesn't like me. You see, about 3 years ago, my dog escaped and pooped on his lawn. I apologized and cleaned it up, but he's never forgiven me.
Hey, I heard that,
Oberon called from the porch.
You told me to poop on his lawn.
Yeah, so what's your point? I asked.
You're making it sound like I'm some ordinary dog who just poops anywhere.
I know, but it's going to get that Simurgian guy in trouble.
Oh, well, that's okay then. I don't like him.
Officer Benton glowered at me for a moment, and then at Leif. But if he was expecting us to confess, he was going to be disappointed. Sorry for disturbing you, he finally growled, and then thought to amend his tone. Have a nice night. He turned his back on us and stalked across the street to Mr. Simurgian's house, muttering to two of the officers that they could go, he'd write it up. They made goodbye noises at him and climbed back into their cars, turning off their lights and motoring away as Officer Benton pounded on Simurgian's door.
Should we worry about him remembering anything? I whispered to Leif.
No, he is still completely in my thrall, he replied in the same low tone.
How are you planning to get rid of the Firbolgs?
I actually hadn't planned that far yet.
You know, for another glass of that fine vintage you have, I can take care of it. Just help me haul them over to Mitchell Park.
I took time to consider. Burying the bodies of 9 giants would not be easy, even if they were already in pieces. Calling on Radomiwa's coven to take care of it was a possibility, but I really didn't want to use up their favor on something like this. How would you take care of it? I asked. He shrugged.
I know some ghouls. I make a couple calls, the guys come over for dinner, problem solved.
They can put away 9 whole giants? There's that many ghouls in town?
Probably not, Leif admitted. But whatever they did not eat tonight, they'll take the rest to go.
I stared at him in disbelief. You mean like a doggy bag? The vampire nodded with a thin trace of a smile.
They have a refrigerated truck, Atticus. These are practical guys. I employ them often, and so does Magnuson on occasion. It is a satisfactory arrangement for everyone.
So I would owe you 3 glasses, I said.
That is correct, and I want them sooner rather than later, since you are apparently marked for death.
I said, to buy myself some time. Officer Benton was writing out a citation for a bewildered Mr. Sumergian across the street. False calls to 911 are a no-no. "Can I pay you one tonight for your firm and the other two tomorrow night?" I asked.
"Why not simply give them all to me tonight?" Leaf replied. "You heal rapidly."
"Well, that's what I'm doing right now," I said. "I have some torn abdominal muscles, a deeply bruised left shoulder, and a couple of vertebrae are out of place."
"Should you not be screaming in pain, then?"
Leaf regarded me skeptically. "Yes, but I've blocked my pain receptors, and I'm going to need my strength if I want to be good as new by morning."
"What are the odds of you surviving until morning?"
"I think they're excellent. I was warned about the arrival of Bress and the Firbolgs, and both have now been dispatched."
"Bress is dead? The former king of the Tuatha De Danann?"
"Manannan Mac Lir take me for a fool. I shouldn't have told him that. It was too late to backpedal, though. If I lied, he'd know it." "Aye, he lost his head up the street moments before I arrived."
"And you did it?"
"Guilty."
"Then I want all three glasses tonight, Atticus, and to hell with your healing. Briot is going to kill you, and this will be my last drink."
I sighed heavily in defeat. I was not about to explain the details of my arrangement with the Morrigan to him. "We wait for Officer Benton to leave," I said. "Then you make your calls and we haul the bodies over to the park. Only after I'm in the clear and my front yard can pass inspection without camouflage will you get your rare vintage."
"Agreed," the vampire said. "I'm full right now anyway. I need to work some of this off."
He dug a cell phone out of his, or I should say my, breast pocket, and used a speed dial number to call someone named Antoine.
"I have dinner for the whole crew at Mitchell Park in Tempe right now. Bring the truck."
"Yes, there's enough for everybody. Trust me. See you there."
Whoa. He had ghouls on speed dial. My lawyer kicks so much ass.
Chapter 12.
Ugh. Yuck. Ugh.
I woke in my backyard stiff from a night spent on the ground and itchy from the grass. Oberon was nestled around my legs, his head resting on my shin. I tried to gently extricate myself so he could continue sleeping if he wished. The night outside had been necessary to speed my healing, especially after surrendering 3 wine glasses of blood for Leaf. I had needed the contact with the ground and the power of the earth. Worth a bit of itching, definitely. I sat up and checked my abdomen. Some stiffness there, no real pain, and the skin had already scabbed over and fallen off, showing me a shiny new pink epidermis. The shoulder was good as new, and my back, while still a bit sore, at least felt like it was straight again. I grinned. After 2,100 years, I still thought magic was pretty damn cool. Oberon picked up his head as I got to my feet, and he took that as his cue to stand and stretch.
"Morning, Atticus."
"Morning. You want a belly rub? Better take it while I'm offering."
"Okay."
He promptly flopped down next to me, lifting his front paws to give me better access. I squatted down and rubbed him vigorously for a few minutes while his tail thumped happily against my leg. "So, what would you like for breakfast today?"
"Sausage."
"You always say that."
"That's because it's always tasty."
"I'm out of sausage. How about some pork chops?"
"Well, I don't know. Did Genghis Khan eat pork chops?"
"Well, I doubt he ate chops, because that's a fairly modern way to cut it. He probably ate slices off a whole ham or something that they had roasted in the ground all day."
"Can I have some of that, then?"
"I don't have a whole pig to roast, nor do I have the time to do it properly. Can't you settle for some chops and just pretend?"
"All right. But after that, can we conquer Siberia or something?"
"Not today, Oberon," I chuckled. "I have a contract to fulfill with the witches.